This session is on the Rohingya and on the false promise of Aung San Suu Kyi. We have a wonderful panel with us today. I'll just sort of introduce them as they speak. But clearly the whole question of the Rohingya refugees, the fact that something like 500,000 Rohingyans have fled from Burma, from Myanmar, since 2017, you know, a huge scale of suffering, dispossession and genocide going on. And the Australian government, of course, has taken none of these. And instead, you know, its refugee policies have helped to lead the way in terms of other nations in the region doing boat turnbacks and so on. There's something like 200 Rohingyans also languishing on Manus and Nauru. So it's a, you know, it's a question for both you know, the region, but also for Australia and, you know, pressuring our own government. So we're going to hear from a range of people, including Rohingyan refugees who are organising around the question and people involved in the refugee movement. So our first speaker is going to be Paul Coates. Paul is a member of Socialist Alternative in Adelaide, and he's involved in the refugee movement there. He's also a teacher in a school with refugees. So welcome, Paul. And he's going to be focusing in particular on the issue of Aung San Suu Kyi and her legacy.
Okay, so today, as Liz said, we're going to hear more about the horrors of the genocide that have been and continue to be inflicted on the Rohingya people in Myanmar, a genocide that's led to, by my reading, at least 700,000, I think, refugees have had to flee over the border into Bangladesh since August last year. The government of Myanmar has murdered at least 10,000 Rohingya in the past 6 months, yet Fortress Australia rejects these people as refugees, instead opting for racist white South African farmers. And meanwhile, the Australian government welcomes their internationally disgraced leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, to Australia with a 19-gun salute. It must have been quite a surprise, actually, to Suu Kyi to not hear the guns turned on her own people. We must recognise the horrific role in the plight of the Rohingya played by our own country, the Australian state. Not only has Australia led the way internationally in boat turnbacks, as Liz mentioned, they've forced Rohingya back or corralled them into horrific Australian detention camps, but the Australian government actively supports the Myanmar military forces through its training courses. In the current financial year, the Australian military increased its financial support to Myanmar military officers to provide university education in the areas of English language, maritime security, international law, joint warfare and peacekeeping. The increase this year of over 30% means that over the last 2 years, Australia has paid $1 to Myanmar military for every displaced Rohingya refugee. The record of Australia for resettling Rohingya people is equally shameful, with only 37 resettled since 2013 and the vast majority of refugees attempting to enter Australia either towed back, stuck in countries like Malaysia, or detained at Manus Island or Nauru, as Liz mentioned. Australia has always been part of the problem in Myanmar, despite the platitudes of our leaders. Only 2 decades ago, the Australian government hosted Aung San Suu Kyi in Australia, in Sydney, for the ASEAN Leaders Summit. The welcome she received was nothing new. She's well acquainted with the open arms of the Australian government. And indeed, this adoration of Suu Kyi has been totally bipartisan over the last many, many years. In November 2010, the Prime Minister of Australia, Julia Gillard, said, following the release of Aung San Suu Kyi from detention, she said, "The Australian people and government share a deep and abiding admiration for you. Your steadfast commitment to democracy and to the welfare of the Burmese people is a source of your inspiration for Australians." Now, we all know that Julia Gillard is a laudable hypocrite, but in this talk, I want to draw our focus to what is now considered, you know, probably one of the most laudable hypocrites of our age, and that's Aung San Suu Kyi herself. Although for many years celebrated by the liberal left as the doyen of non-violent peace and resistance in the face of a brutal military dictatorship in Myanmar, today the tide of establishment support appears to have turned against her. Today, even the most crony ideologues of world liberal humanitarianism are saying that the emperor has no clothes. Suu Kyi has been pilloried, rightly, in the world press for her supposed silence in the face of the brutal massacre of Rohingya people in Rakhine State. For example, Live Aid founder Bob Geldof, some of you might remember him, one of many international celebrities who parade the international circuit, humanitarian circuit, draping themselves in self-righteous awards bestowed upon them, by the world imperialist elite for their supposed good deeds, recently referred to Suu Kyi as, quote, the handmaiden of genocide. No gentle words there, and surprisingly accurate. On Christmas Eve 2017, The Guardian newspaper reported that a children's book, refreshingly titled Good Night Stories for Rebel Girls, one of the most popular children's books in 2017 and one likely to appear in many Christmas stockings, had run into controversy because Suu Kyi appeared as one of the 100 women in its pages. Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls is a liberal feminist fairy tale, a collection of real-life stories about female role models from Amelia Earhart and Marie Curie, Hillary Clinton and Serena Williams, inspiring girls to aim high and challenge the status quo. At the time that the book was written, Aung San Suu Kyi was deemed a worthy subject, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize and supposedly the epitome of courage in the face of oppression. But her fall from grace over her response to the violence against the Rohingya, described even by the UN as possible genocide, triggered calls for her to be taken out of future editions. One British Labour MP, Yasmin Qureshi, said this about Suu Kyi's appearance in the book. She said, "I have no doubt that history will remember her as the leader who watched on while mass killing, systematic rape and ethnic cleansing of hundreds of thousands who were forced to live in squalid refugee camps. I'd encourage the authors of the book to consider that there is an entire generation of young Rohingya children who are stateless and hopeless, suffering a miserable existence. Aung San Suu Kyi's refusal to condemn makes her complicit." Since late last year, the condemnations haven't seemed to stop. On the 1st of March, three Nobel Peace Prize laureates met with Rohingya in sprawling refugee camps and accused fellow Nobel Peace recipient Aung San Suu Kyi and Myanmar's military of committing genocide in the deadly violence that had forced hundreds of thousands to flee. One of these laureates said she should, quote, wake up or face prosecution. But we know that Suu Kyi's purported silence is so much more than willful neglect. It is not simply the case that she needs to wake up. She is awake and she is plotting. Her silence is a loud silence, a telling silence. In fact, on quite a few occasions, she has very actively hosed down the severity and magnitude of the violence. She said, quote, "I don't think there is an ethnic cleansing going on," she told the BBC. She said, I think ethnic cleansing is too strong an expression for what is happening. And she asserts this in the face of the cold, naked reality that Myanmar's military are regularly broadcast in international media, slaughtering, torturing and raping Rohingya in their thousands. And aid workers have frequently been blocked access to the conflict zone. What's more, she's been keen to try and deflect from the reality and to scapegoat Muslims, claiming the violence is also, quote, Muslims killing Muslims as well, or claiming cynically that mothers whose babies were executed in front of them as part of the terror campaign can return and the false assurance that they will be safe. It is not the case, as Kevin Rudd wrote in the New York Times, that Suu Kyi just has very few options in this very, you know, complex situation. This kind of apologising simply masks the fact that she is an active proponent in the problem and is perhaps more telling of Kevin Rudd's desire to cover his own tracks and the tracks of those around him for being a Suu Kyi admirer in the past. But despite all of this, it can't be stressed enough what a dramatic sea change this is. The fact that the international establishment, at least on the face of it, turned their noses up at her. Only a year ago, Suu Kyi, dubbed the Lady for her polite upper-crusted speeches and carefully poised photographs with the rich and powerful, was held aloft by the world establishment as a stoic symbol of democracy and righteousness. What a change from this to now being compared to the likes of Margaret Thatcher. In 2011, when a film biopic titled The Lady was released, the bleeding hearts of the liberal commentariat were lining up to prove that they were more moved and shed more tears than anyone else in the audience. The Daily Telegraph proclaimed the film could never be good enough. It was, quote, a pale imitation of the inspirational fighter for democracy. David Stratton of the ABC said Suu Kyi was, quote, beautifully played by actor Michelle Yeoh, the epitome of grace and calm. For two decades, countless journalists have written her fabled biography and embellished it like a Grimm's fairy tale. So I want to talk more about what's behind the fairy tale and who is this Rapunzel character, this Burmese leader of now ill repute. Today, Aung San Suu Kyi is the highest paid politician in the world, pulling in an astonishing $75 million between January 2017 and January 2018, a nearly $40 million lead over her closest competition. The Burmese politician has an estimated net worth of over $215 million. She owes her fortune to stock investments, substantial property holdings and lucrative endorsement deals with CoverGirl Cosmetics. She also owns several restaurants. There's one called the Fat Aung Suu Kyi Burger chain in Rangoon. She owns a football team, the Rangoon Angels. She's launched her own brand of vodka called Pure Wonder Ung and is tackling the juniors market with a top-selling perfume called With Love Some Aung San Suu Kyi. She also owns a fashion line called the Aung San Suu Kyi Seduction Line. Aung San Suu Kyi's beginnings were hardly humble. She was always well acquainted with power and privilege. Suu Kyi is the daughter of Aung San, a communist turned nationalist who collaborated with Myanmar's Japanese occupiers during World War II before switching sides to join the British in overseeing the transition to independence. Her father was assassinated in 1947, a year before independence, when she was only 2 years old. Like many young establishment children, she completed a lot of her education abroad, away from the poverty and deprivation of Myanmar, and studied later on at Oxford University and the University of London. I think that's where she got the accent. And later worked at the United Nations headquarters in New York. Like others on her trajectory, she mixed in ruling class circles. Meanwhile, back in Myanmar, the military had dominated the nation's economy since General Nguyen, formerly a close confidant of Aung San, took power in a military coup in 1962. Adopting socialist rhetoric, Nguyen nationalised all land, industry and commerce and set up a one-party totalitarian regime. The planned economy he established was not socialism for the masses, but rather socialism for army officers, whose plunder of the nation's wealth of mineral resources continues today. But a crisis was looming for the regime. Once the world's largest exporter of rice, by the mid-1970s, Myanmar barely produced enough to feed its own population. Per capita income fell from $670 in 1960 to $200, less than a third, in 1989. Rising fuel prices in 1988 spurred a popular uprising, forcing Nguyen into retirement. Suu Kyi returned to Burma from Britain in 1988 in the midst of the social movement against the military dictatorship known as the 8th of the 8th, 88 uprising. When she returned, she was in close contact with several retired army officers who'd grown disillusioned with Nguyen's authoritarian regime. Together, they founded the National League for Democracy, and Suu Kyi soon became the party's general secretary. The NLD represented those sections of the Burmese bourgeoisie whose economic interests were stifled under the military junta. Aligned with Western imperialism, they sought to open up the country to foreign investment. In 1990, the NLD won a landslide election victory, gaining 80% of the vote. The military junta refused to recognise the results and placed Suu Kyi under house arrest. She was imprisoned in her rather lavishly comfortable family mansion, where, so the fairy tale goes, she languished in stoic non-violent non-conformism until her eventual release in 1995. Throughout her years of detention, Suu Kyi did little to advocate for Myanmar's oppressed ethnic minorities. After her release, there was another spectacular electoral victory, which was followed by a further period of house arrest. As president of the NLD, she was again released in 2010 after nearly two decades of house arrest by the regime. Throughout this period, the Western media continued to champion her as a living monument of so-called non-violent resistance, held up in the same league as India's Gandhi or Black America's Martin Luther King. Even U2's, another nasty character, U2's frontman Bono, called her, quote, the kind of Mandela of our moment. He said, she's a character of great grace. Her struggle has become a symbol of what's best and worst about humanity. Now, his use of the word grace, and a number of other people use that word as well, is no accident. Because like any kind of fairy tale story, style matters. And Suu Kyi has really become a bit of a style icon. You know, we can think of other fairy tales. You know, Rapunzel has the long flowing hair, Cinderella had the glass slipper, Little Red Riding Hood has the red hood, and Gandhi has the loincloth. But Suu Kyi, on the other hand, is widely cited for her grace and her poise and her smooth-talking eloquence, kind of like a Burmese Barack Obama. Julia Gillard once again said this about Suki in the Australian Parliament. She said, quote, Ernest Hemingway famously said that courage was best defined as grace under pressure. If those words are true, then there are no better examples of courage that better example of courage than Aung San Suu Kyi. Her dulcet-toned, upper-crusted accent wielded with all the false modesty of a Gucci handbag, and her willingness to shake a dainty hand with any world leader, no matter how warmongering or how hypocritical, and her polite sidestepping of confrontation in the international arena won her the appeal of the world liberal elite, who could claim cynically that she expresses herself with the calm conviction and passion that reflects her supposedly humble Buddhist upbringing. 2016 was a turning point. The victory of the NLD in a carefully managed elections in 2016 and the installment of Suu Kyi as de facto head of government was, unsurprisingly, universally hailed by the establishment media, middle-class liberals, and even some left organisations as the flowering of democracy in Myanmar. With Suu Kyi at the helm, the fairy tale was finally in the happily ever finale. But the fairy tale was just the start of a new nightmare for the Rohingya people. In reality, the military remained in charge. It appointed officers to a quarter of the parliamentary seats and installed several generals to key posts of defence, home affairs and border affairs. Suu Kyi and the NLD went along with this charade because their basic concern was never with democratic rights as such, but with capitalist investment in partnership with the West. Moreover, the NLD, Suu Kyi included, is just as mired as the military in the reactionary ideology of Burmese Buddhist supremacism, which has repeatedly been exploited to sow religious and ethnic divisions amongst working people in Myanmar. As hopes for an economic boom in Burma have faded, the military, with the NLD's backing, has escalated violence against Muslim Rohingyas, who long have been used as a scapegoat for the country's problems. The Rohingya are denied citizenship under the 1982 Myanmar Nationality Law created by the Nguyen regime, which was ethnically Burma nationalist. The laws deny Rohingya the possibility of acquiring a nationality, which meant that over 1 million people in Myanmar were not regarded as citizens. They cannot vote, they have no access to government assistance, and are exploited as cheap labour. And it is this system and the brutal crackdown on Rohingya that took place recently that Aung San Suu Kyi willingly and enthusiastically presides over. It might seem remarkable that the world elite have turned against her, but it is not because, of course, they have changed or become more humanitarian, or indeed because they care about the plight of the Rohingya people. World capitalist leaders are happy to change their allegiances when it doesn't suit them, or when the crimes of the despots that they sponsor become too difficult to justify or ignore. In this case, crimes are too big to ignore. The fairy tale has drifted too far from the yellow brick road, and the facts have asserted themselves. Of course, the epitome of ruling class scorn and shame on their own comes with the repealing of the Nobel Prize of Suu Kyi. But we should remind ourselves that this prize was never meaningful in the first place. Nobel Peace Prizes have always been about rewarding murderers. The prizes have always been, according to Guardian columnist Awa Madawi, quote, a who's who of hawks, hypocrites and war criminals. There are many, many examples, like the 1973 recipient Henry Kissinger, rewarded for his efforts in negotiating a ceasefire in the Vietnam War, but who, meanwhile, was carpet bombing Cambodia. Or Shimon Peres, awarded the prize in 1994 with Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat, and who for decades was helping to amp up Israel's nuclear capabilities. And 2 years after his prize, was then responsible for a massacre that killed over 100 people sheltering in a UN compound in Lebanon. Suu Kyi is not, as some have proffered, a disgrace to the Nobel Prize. She is totally at home with the barbarians and thieves who make up this honour roll. Aung San Suu Kyi may be amongst the greatest hypocrites today of our day, but capitalism has always been ruled by hypocrites, murderers, genocidists and self-serving billionaires who tried to disguise their atrocities under the bloody banner of humanitarianism. So we have every reason to expect that the hypocrisy and brutality will continue in Myanmar, unless ordinary people can end it. As Nick Everett wrote in an excellent piece on Sue Key for the Red Flag newspaper, so long as the democracy icon will be the smiling face of Myanmar's brutal military regime, keeping the door open to foreign investment, it's business as usual for Western diplomats and entrepreneurs in Myanmar.
Our next speaker is going to be Habib Rahman. Habib is one of the founders, I believe, of the Australian Rohingya Burmese Association, and he's a Rohingya refugee. He's been recognised as a refugee here in Australia, but has been denied by the Australian government a travel visa to be able to go and address the European Parliament. So the oppression continues, not just, you know, the whole years and years of being a refugee, having to flee Myanmar, being in refugee camps, but now under the Australian government. So welcome, Habib.
Thank you very much. Thanks to everyone and giving us an opportunity to present about our Rohingya situation here. And thanks to all of you for listening and anticipation. And I have the same respect to Aboriginal leaders and past and present elders and all of you and all of you working for the welfare of the betterment of our concern for Rohingya. Thank you very much. So I will talk about the situation back in home and transit country and how Rohingya people have been facing difficulties that will be shared by my friends and also our chairman, the AVR chairman. So, situation back in home, just recently from 25th of August, not only the military and also the Rakhine Armed Forces that did ceasefire agreement with the government and they jointly with trained Rakhine people. So, they attacked Rohingya civilians in Mondo, Bukidam, and using fight helicopter, rocket launcher, tanks, and also heavy weapons, and also the villager, even children, women, elderly people, they've been burned alive in the house, and tie them up, and really alive, and brutally killing, and also tie up and throwing into the water. So it's very horrible, and children, as like ladies as young as age 12, were raped. Baby, even according to MSF report just conducted for the first arrival, they found more than 6,700 people have been brutally killed. So about 660 are babies under 1 year. Just recently come up the ASEAN parliamentary human rights reports based on Bangladesh independent reports showing that more than 43,000 people have been killed. Because they counted, there are more than 40,000 orphans and widows and siblings they lost in there. So how many dead more in such, we're not sure. And wipe out nearly 700,000 of people and burn down 400 houses. So it's all total about 90% of total population and total property. They've been completely destroyed. Those the building and the houses, those are not destroyed. By following morning, the government will those cleanse them and replacing with military base camps and also a mega Vienna project invested heavily from China. So the case that you see, they are only left about 10% of population. It's numbering about 300,000 to 400,000 people. Of them, 150,000 people are still in 42 concentration camps across Arkan states. And they've been there for more than 5 years. The people have been segregated, separated, discriminated, and banned from everything. Medicare, water, access to water, or education, or ration, or anything they block as much as they can. So the people are trapped. They are waiting to be dead, or they have to escape from there. And they cannot even escape. Those escape through by land. They've been captured. We have report come from the central Burma, in Burmese newspaper, they saying that in 1st of March and 16th and 17th March, in three groups, they arrested more than 64 Rohingya, as they calling them Bengali and like intruder and illegal immigrant, they're firing them. So some of them are not even Rohingya, they are command who are recognized under the current the government. Even they are, they've been attacked, they've been forced into concentration camp and branded as a recent arrival illegal immigrant. So the attack is not only Rohingya, we have another community called Aman Muslim who are living in Rakhine State as well. So they've been also subject to the same thing. And the attack from 2012, if you look back, the way they attack, like the people are traveling to Rohingya living area and then organizing like long knife and bow, arrow. So all of them are one factory made. So these are very organized. And before the crisis, 8th of June 2012, they cut off electrical supply, the water and transportation, communication, everything. So Rohingya don't have even right to hold a phone or having foreign band radio listening or having foreign contact or speaking English or supporting like language support worker or whoever they will be straight away, taken away. So this is really, really horrible. It is time of this worse than the case genocide. And the later, this attack spread to across Central Burma, attack taking place in five places, Magwe, Pogo, Yango, Mandalay, and also burned down more than 10,000 houses and displaced more than 20,000 people. And the nationalists and then the very allied Burmese, they come to say they want to build their village. They bring up the signboard saying that Muslim free zone, Muslim free village. That same as they did in 1983 in the Rakhine State, that comprising four townships, Tangothan, Ruibwa, and Ponajuan. This four township has been defined as a Muslim free zone. So whoever traveling through there will be captured and handed over to Rakhine people, then they will be executed straight away. So we have many documents that there have been more than 100 people killed in this manner. So this case has been not today, this has been happening for a long time. We have more than 20 United Nations agencies working on the ground from 1991. So the attack also taken place in 1994-95 in Mount Lopukidau, where more than 4,000 youth has been taken away under the former Secretary General Kenya, Secretary Wan, and they never returned. And again in 1991, we have clearance operation called Pitaya operation also. More than 200,000 people displaced and vandalizing and seizing village and replacement with modern village men, the so-called modern village men. The Rakhine people are newly arrived, have been settled into those Rohingya village, and then the ex-prisoner from Bas and Burma, they've been brought to there, and then the land of Rohingya and the property, the crops, animals, all been shared to them. So the same thing today happening, who want to settle in Mount Lopukidau region, they've been getting bounty for the taking place over Rohingya people places. And then the authority has, in the camp, authority has started blocking operation, saying that whatever you have all identity, you have to hand it over if you want ration. Because some Rohingya today in the camp, they have come up with their own identity or copy. They say, look, I've been recognized once, and then I have identity. I am government service. This debt has clearly written Rohingya, ethnicity Rohingya. So I am a citizen of Burma. So there is no such law or no such thing that my parents are also citizen, and we've been living in there. So we are recognized. So for this purpose, the government has, the camp authority has started a seizing of their own identity in return of ration supply. And also many other people to show that the people have been settling slowly. The list has been, many people has been erased from the list. For example, according to our list in 2012, June, more than 200,000 people have been displaced. Nearly 90,000 fled into Bangladesh and about 150,000 people in this 42 concentration camp. But today the government showing only 120,000 or some people. But the number is more than that. Many people are not listed. Many people have been saying that you're not abide by the rule and regulation here. We not see you, so you'll be no more in the camp. So for example, Pauto, which one is the opposite side of Sitwe, we have the village, more than 17 Rohingya village, all of them being cleansed, and the people have been pushed into concentration camp, some of them being able to move to Sitwe. So they are clearing the land after them, like back in 1978, back in 1991. So the government, these are very clear the agenda of the government, directly from the government. The government sometimes use their military forces, their authorities, sometimes they're using Rakhine nationalist people from the front under the title of democratization or transition. So this democracy of Burma today become majority representative Buddhist democracy, only available to Buddhism, not for any other minority, even not for minority, not only Rohingya. You will see clearly today if you look refugee population across Thailand, Bangladesh, and India, or Malaysia, all of them are ethnic minority. There are a few Burmans but on political grounds, but most of them are ethnic minority. So not only the camp in today. We have the camp in Kashin State, Shan State, ongoing war in Karen State. So the minority has been getting attacked for a long time. Well, we have not seen United Nations or the developed country or international community has taken effective action on Burma. Because like the government very defines, like Suu government, she pretends to be she knowing nothing, but it is not. She using her limited power to block UN Inquiry Commission, blocking ration, blocking aid supply, and blocking also independent journalists, and lying situation on the ground saying that this is not happening and she doesn't know. And she's saying this is fake rape and this is not happening. But actually we have Myanmar Defense and Security Council that has 11 members, so Suu Kyi and NLD power, and Suu Kyi herself has two positions. So half of them have NLD position in that 11 seat. So all kind of operation that they have to approve through Security Council. So the Suu Kyi knowingly approved that this has been happening. How come she says she doesn't know? She knows everything. And she just pretends to be she doesn't know. So under her popular reason, so the people has been perished today completely. So the totally destroyed, we have to say Rohingya people has been totally destroyed. If you look again, 1982 citizenship law saying that most of the people are the today new generation, they are thinking Rohingya are not qualified, but it is not. It is authority who intentionally reluctant to assess the ancestral and historical abidance that Rohingya have. That's why the government, they destroy historical building, the village, those are 300-400-500 years old, they destroy everything, seizing identity, not allowing to recourse to become citizenship under their invented citizenship law. So these are very clear how the government has been actively, intentionally, the wiping of the people. They are clearly targeting. If you look at 78 and again look back in 91 and again 94, 95 and 2012, June, and repeatedly this been happening, they clean up. So on the round table talk, United Nations Security Council talk there, so the people have been wiping out more and more slowly, and then the people have been all been wiping out. Only 10% left, they are also systematic confinement. So even UN has not used the power even to travel onto the ground, not used the power even to deliver food and aid as they are freely to the victim directly. So it is very upsetting situation. So the in Bangladesh, in situation in Bangladesh also, they are very tough situation. So the refugee has been, this Rohingya refugee has been mishandled by IOM, international broker. We say international broker IOM. They've been not given identity saying Rohingya refugee, but they've been given displaced people from Myanmar. And they are trying to easily return to Burma without improvement of situation in Burma. If that going to, if that is true, then they have to start with the people who are trapped in 42 concentration camps, allowing them for relocation, allowing them to lifting all restrictions. Then we can see situation improve and start repatriation. But no, now that the different thing happening, same as back in 1978 and 1992, false promise have been given. Forceful repatriation have been taken place, so we are afraid that this will be happening. So thank you very much. So I will pass my friend to say something about the Rohingya people facing difficulties in Australia. Thank you.
Thanks, Habib. So if that's not genocide, I don't know what is. Pretty horrific stuff. Our next speaker is going to be Shofiqul Islam. Shofiqul is the current chair of the Australian Burmese Rohingyan Association, and he's also an organiser with the National Union of Workers, organising amongst farm workers, many of which are refugees and undocumented migrants. So welcome, Shofiqul.
I'm starting with Aung San Suu Kyi, some of the good and bad. The previous speakers speak a lot, covered everything. So with Aung San Suu Kyi, she is in Burma, 100% of population of people are still strongly supporting to her. And she's previously a democratic icon. What's happening today with her is a little bit strange and illogical thing. She shouldn't be treated to the people on public like the way she's doing today. So military is exceeds 25% in parliament already. So there will be a 75% will be an election. And during while she was in house arrest, military campaign anti Aung San Suu Kyi around Burma, the public still strongly supporting to her because we as a public would expect that she'll bring a fully democracy and full peace into Burma. And the military were not success, and the military then started to campaign against a Rohingya or Muslim campaign. It's been around at least more than 10 years. So how do I realize that? Because I was born in Rakhine State, where is the Rohingya mostly living. So I left Rakhine State when I was 8 years old. I was growing up in Yangon, which is more diverse, and with Burmese students and Chinese and many others, Christians or Hindu, whoever. So I have started in Yangon year 3 to complete high school and again in university. So what we found that is with the Muslims and other minority, we've been constitutionally and also institutionally mistreated. I was also a part of the minority. I faced racism through to my life, and many of the other minorities like Muslims and other Indian backgrounds and Christians, they also say that the Rohingya is the worst. So the way what's happening with the Rohingya issue with the Aung San Suu Kyi today, she cannot really outspoken and stand with the Rohingya because the military run a campaign. The way they did is through to the media and publish around in TV or social media, Facebook, newspaper, so the public become very much anti-Rohingya. So the way she doing is today is if she's spoken up, she will definitely lose her vote. So she will not be able to rescue her life the way she may be. So with the Rohingya crisis, even some of her strong supporters, the pro-democrats or whoever, they're not supporting with this the Rohingya crisis because they become very much anti and racist with the Muslim. So she will not be able to do by herself, even if she want to. Some of the minister, some of the very close and some of her very strong support, even in Australia, for many of the Burmese people, they claim themselves as a pro-democrat and the supporter of the Aung San Suu Kyi. They're not supporting to the Aung San Suu Kyi. So she took initial as a first step in the publicity because the Rohingya wars has become very much sensitive within the public. She asked people not to use illegal migrants or racist word, but the people don't really accept listen to, not standing with her. So I would say rather than pushing only pressure on the Burmese government and the Aung San Suu Kyi, we also need to do some more work in the public in Australia and also in Burma. How do we bring harmony within the communities? How do we end ethnic wars and the religious wars within the public? That's also an important thing. Blaming and criticism and putting pressure is not enough. And also some of the issues in Australia with the Rohingya within Burmese communities around with the many other Karen, Kachin, and the Rohingyas also the same. We should also work and put a bit pressure on them, stop them blaming us as an illegal migrants from Burma, from Bangladesh, and using a Bengali term in that time, and also build a structure of the communities organizing and build a capacity with our community, and also working by ourselves, involving all the refugees around here in Australia, and we can work more, put pressure or bring harmony in Burma. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Shofiqul. Our final speaker is going to be Helen Jarvis. Helen is a member of Socialist Alternative as well, based in Wollongong?
No. Cambodia.
Oh, you're now in Cambodia. Yeah, you've been there for a while. I think you're someone else. I think you're Mark. Anyway, another person. Yes, based in Cambodia. And she's been on the People's Tribunal on Myanmar, and so looking at some of the war crimes there. So thank you, Helen.
Thanks. Thank you so much for the previous presentations, and so important to hear from the Rohingya people themselves about what they've been experiencing and how they assess the situation in Rakhine State and in Myanmar. I've involved in a group called the Permanent People's Tribunal, which is based in Rome. And this was a tribunal that was established during the Vietnam War by the philosophers Jean-Paul Sartre and Bertrand Russell. So they had the first tribunals about the US war crimes in Vietnam. And then they went on to have further tribunals about the military dictatorships in South and Central America. And then it became established as a permanent people's tribunal. The idea that they had was that most of the serious crimes against peoples are committed by states. So how come we leave it to the states themselves to set up the justice system to bring justice? So their idea is that the peoples have rights. And there was a Universal Declaration of the Rights of People held in Algiers in 1967, and that's the basis of the work of the Permanent People's Tribunal. The tribunal is very small, it's a tiny secretariat, but it responds to requests from groups around the world, and they've had, I think, something like 45 different tribunals over the years, not only in human rights issues, but also more lately in structural issues of the role of the IMF and of big pharma and mega projects displacing people and so forth. So it's, I think, an interesting way to approach some of these issues. And I've been on the tribunal twice, once with regard to the Elam Tamil people in Sri Lanka, and once with the Rohingya. Then I was also involved in an independent one on Indonesia, what happened in 1965 in Indonesia, which was organised by a group of activists in Indonesia and in Europe, but it was independent of the Permanent People's Tribunal. So just to explain what it was, we held two sessions last year in 2017. Well, actually, the issue of the Rohingya was brought to the attention of the People's Tribunal in 2013 when we were sitting on the question of the Elam Tamils. And one of our members is Zani, who's a Burmese activist and scholar, who was one of our panel on the Elam Tamils. And at the time, he brought to the attention of the tribunal that this was a case that should be taken up. The tribunal does not initiate cases. It responds to requests. And so the message was back to Zani that if he could seek support in the Rohingya community, and also they like the tribunal doesn't want to be just responding to one particular small group or large group, but tries to get broader representation in the communities and among activist supporters. So through 2014, 2015, something like, I think it was 28 Rohingya groups wrote a common letter to the tribunal asking for a session. And we had a lot of discussion, and it was decided also that it would be open, that we that the tribunal did not want to hold a session just on the Rohingya, but wanted to address the question of repression in Myanmar against other groups as well. And so it was open to Rohingya and other groups. And the Kachin, another subgroups of, four, I think five or eight Kachin groups came together and asked to join the tribunal, and they did so. And then we held the first session in London in March last year. And then after that, there were requests from other Muslims in Myanmar, so similar to I think what Habib told us about the attacks, the Muslim free zones, the attacks around, they joined as well. So the session that we held in Kuala Lumpur, which was the main session in September last year, was called State Crimes Allegedly Committed in Myanmar Against the Rohingya, Kachin and Other Groups. It seemed incredible at the time because our session was held in, as I say, middle of September. Of course, the preparations had been going on for some years beforehand. And there have been report after report after report coming out over those last few years. But of course, when we held our session, was right in the middle of the extreme crisis. And we were able to hear a number of witnesses. The People's Tribunal is a very different thing from the International Criminal Court or the International Criminal Tribunal. One big difference is we have no power of enforcement. It's an opinion tribunal. We can just say what we think is the truth. And the other thing is that the sessions bring together witnesses, reports and so forth, but it's a fairly short process. And at the end of the few days of the hearings, we issue a judgment and then write it up over the coming period. But it doesn't go on for 5-10 years. I've been involved in the tribunal in Cambodia. It's been going on for 12 years now and isn't finishing yet. But the advantage is that we can actually speak and put the voice of the witnesses and the people who've come before us. The tribunal always offers the chance of the people who are alleged to have committed the crimes the chance to be represented. So a defence was invited, and letters were sent to Aung San Suu Kyi, of course, but also the chief, a whole range of, I think about 10 or 12 different people, the president, the different ministers, and of course the military to come along, starting from the commander-in-chief down. They didn't accept the invitation. They didn't appear at all. They didn't present any written defence. But we thought it was important symbolically. We had a chair in the tribunal every day. The presiding judge on the panel said, "Is there anybody here representing the Myanmar government position? And please take your seat," but nobody ever did. So in that case, the tribunal statutes require that there's an attempt made to bring forward the position of the person in defence. So there's a what we call amicus curiae, a friend of the court presentation. But because the situation was unfolding so quickly, when we were right in the middle of what was happening, There wasn't really time to even pull together because it was changing by the minute. But what was quite extraordinary was that on the 19th of September, so on the second day of the tribunal, Aung San Suu Kyi herself made this big speech. Many of you would probably have seen it in Naypyidaw, where she spoke to all the assembled diplomats and press and so forth in English. And so we listened, the panel of judges listened to that speech and decided to accept that as the defence position of the government, and it was summarised in our findings. So the main points that I really want to make, I won't go through the judgment, is just that we thought it was very important to look at the structural situation, the longer term situation that had brought this about, as we've had described the progressive diminution or elimination of rights of people who had been a part of the society for many hundreds of years, and how this has increased after 1962, but particularly after 1982 with the citizenship laws, how the tricks have been played with the verification cards and the previous cards, hand them in and you'll get a new card. Yes, but the new card doesn't mention Rohingya or doesn't give you citizenship. This also is the case in for the other Muslims. Now, this is a later development, is that you can't be Burman and Muslim. If you're a Muslim, you have to find some other ethnic identity that's recognised under the constitution. So you could be a Muslim Kachin or a Muslim something else. So it's forcing people to renounce their identity, basically, and that's what we looked at in the tribunal. And with the Kachin, it's a different situation. They've been very formally recognised as legitimate members of the Burmese society or community, nation, but they've been systematically persecuted and marginalised and pushed from exercising those rights. So we thought it was important to bring those structural things together. We found that there were war crimes committed against the Kachin, which was an armed situation. We found that crimes against humanity had been committed against the three different groups that we heard. We had, I think, about 20 witnesses came forward. Some of them were held in camera. Some of them were brave and enough or able to speak even in public about what had happened to them. And we heard expert witnesses and so forth. So the crimes against humanity, we found, had been established. And then we addressed the question of genocide. And we found that there was an intent, a general intent from the Myanmar government to commit genocide against all the groups, but that it was being implemented against the Rohingya. So what we looked at under genocide is going back to what Raphael Lemkin came up with genocide, which is an elimination of the identity of the people and the replacement by the oppressor nation. So even the denial of their existence comes into the understanding of genocide. We see genocide as a process. It's not just something that takes place one day. It's a process. And we saw that process is actually taking place across the country with regard to the other groups, but of course in the case of the Rohingya, it was in the extreme form of implementation at that time. And the figures that were given, even, you know, when we were sitting, you know, have been even more extreme now, as was mentioned, that, you know, perhaps there's only 10% of the community left now inside the country. And not only are we hearing these horrific individual testimony about what has happened, but we also know that the villages have been not only burnt but even now bulldozed. eliminated, even the geographical features that people, if they did come back, what is left to remind them of their homeland. So that's the work of the tribunal. The judgment is there if anyone wants to look at it. It's online under Tribunal on Myanmar. It's going to be published soon as well. Just in closing, if I can, of course, this is just one tiny little bit of work among so much work that is being done to document what is happening and to condemn and to support the Rohingya people. One issue that has been raised is, okay, what's going to happen? The UN is calling for safe, dignified and voluntary return, but the question is returning to what? What would be the situation? How can Bangladesh support a million extra people in a country that is already hugely densely populated and suffering natural catastrophes as well as economic pressures, and having had its own genocide in the early 70s, which is something that sometimes gets forgotten. But, you know, what? And are other countries going to accept, what did you say, 37 people had been, who said that? Oh, yeah, 37, Australia's accepted 37 out of a million, you know, unbelievable. But then the other thing that has been raised is what protected return to a protected homeland is a call that some groups have started to make now. Should there be a safe zone inside, in Rakhine State, for people to return? Who would protect? Who would be the protector? Is the question raised, of course. We have, many of us have had severe opposition to the humanitarian intervention that has been undertaken in the name of humanitarian intervention, military interventions by the United States in particular. So these are questions of, you know, what really can be done. I'd just like in closing to say two things that have happened recently that might be of interest to you. One is a book just published last week electronically. It's called No Rohingya. And it's written by a Frenchman who happens to be living in Cambodia. And it's a novel, just a short, like, novel series of chapters. And it's a beautiful book. It's available on, it's an e-book for the huge price of $3.25 US dollars. But you can get it under something called Lulu. I've never heard of it before. But anyway, it's an e-book you can download, No Rohingya. It's a very powerful read, I think. And the other thing is, no time to go into it now, really, except perhaps in discussion if people want to, is that a number of Australian lawyers filed an appeal to the Australian government under universal jurisdiction, the doctrine of universal jurisdiction for war crimes, crimes against humanity, against Aung San Suu Kyi. This was filed on the Friday before on the starting day of the ASEAN-Australia summit, which was, of course, very good timing in terms of drawing attention to the issue and because she was in the country. So she could have been arrested at that time. But under Australian law, the Attorney General has to consent to apply the universal jurisdiction, which is available under our law. And he said no. So now it's going up. They're applying to the High Court to have this reviewed, because what's the point of having it in our legal system if the Attorney General can just at the whim dismiss it? So this is something to watch carefully. I think here the chances of anything going forward are remote, but it's a very important case, I think, and a case to fight. So thank you, and there's so much going on to support. I think probably people will want to do